720 WGN. I'm Mark Harmon. She is Hannah Stanley. We are sitting in for Patty Vasquez with you till 2 in the morning. We have an outstanding guest on the line. His name is Jamie Calvin. He is the executive director of the Invisible Institute, and he is the reason, or at least one of the main reasons, why we eventually saw the footage of Laquan McDonald being shot 16 times. And, of course, the news today is Ronald Johnson, and there are protests going on around the city. So Jamie is just an outstanding person to have on the air right now as our city continues to spin in ways that none of us should want it to. Jamie, first of all, thanks for taking time. Welcome to WGN. I figure we could start with your thoughts on what you heard from Cook County State's attorney, Anita Alvarez, who, of course, brought charges against James Van Dyke, but is not bringing charges against the officer with and Ronald Johnson. What's your reaction to that as we started off here?
You know, I haven't really had a chance to assess the Johnson case. You know, and I think one of the dangers at a moment like this, when we're all confronting the sort of underlying conditions, the sort of toxic culture in the police department, is to rush too quickly to make assumptions about particular cases. You know, so I think we should take care in how we assess the Johnson case. And I haven't had a chance to do so. I mean, you know, my experience has been with the sort of overall statistics of outcomes in terms of police investigations, which, you know, I think the mayor said something today about it sort of defies common sense when you see how difficult it is to discipline a police officer or criminally charge them. So there's the larger kind of macro thing. But I think we should, you know, take care not to jump to judgment about individual cases until we've really, examined the evidence.
You've been instrumental in definitely making sure a lot of this comes to light, not just the video, but working on getting an awareness of the fact that there's not a lot of discipline that's going on to the Chicago Police Department. Do you have kind of a gut feeling on why, or definitely have investigated why you think? Is it a union thing? Is it kind of, it's an old boys network? Why are we having problems disciplining within our own?
You know, that's a really good question, and I rarely get asked that. I mean, I think it's a mix of different factors that have created a culture over time that nobody in their right mind would decide was a good idea for law enforcement. And I think we're going to see now, I mean, just in the last week, think of all the extraordinary disclosures, apart from, you know, the events at the level of the firing of the superintendent and the head of the Independent Police Review Authority. You know, we've had, after the video came out in the Laquan McDonald case, other videos, more are going to come out. This mass of police reports in the Laquan McDonald case that demonstrate a kind of, really show you sort of the molecular structure of the code of silence. It's, for your listeners, it's worth looking at some of these documents to see police officers on the scene. I mean, moments after the boy had been shot, fabricating a story of what had happened. So there's a deeply entrenched culture that, I think must be, I know from officers I know, creates a kind of toxic working environment. And it's going to take real leadership to change that, and it's going to take time. But I think the first order of business, and that's what we're engaged in now, and I think this is an extraordinary moment in the life of the city, is to acknowledge the realities, you know, to get the information out there, to tell these stories, to, debate the evidence and acknowledge the realities. It's really a precondition for being smart about how to go about fixing it. I mean, what we see now in individual cases like the Laquan McDonald case, and I think in a larger sense, in terms of really the state of the city as far as policing is concerned, is this intense effort on the part of the department to control the narrative. You know,
yep.
That's the Laquan McDonald story, right? Trying to control the narrative. Well, they don't have control of it anymore.
Well, and that became the Burge story. That became it has become so many stories of them. And really, if we go back in the history of the city, they were always able to until now we have
video,
documentable sources, et cetera, and find reporters like you, writers, who are digging deeper than we ever were able to before.
But, you know, it's a really important point, though, because we're in these last weeks, you know, there's been a tendency, this kind of media frenzy around which I am grateful for and had a role in generating. But, you know, a tendency to treat something like the Laquan McDonald case as a unique occurrence, you know, and the talk of cover up and conspiracy and all of that. I understand where that's coming from. But the truth is, and I don't want to minimize the absolute horror of the execution of this boy on the streets of Chicago, but the institutional response, what happened after that crime was committed, is not a departure from the norm. It's the norm. I mean, this is the way the department operates. And I think that should really give us pause. It'd be, in a way, comforting if it were a conspiracy, you know, if there were four people in a room who decided how they were going to suppress and contain this case, and they could be prosecuted for their bad deeds. I mean, this was really how the culture responds, and at every level and at every turn, you know, the first instinct of officers on the scene, and then up the food chain and over time, was to circle the wagons and to, as we were saying a moment ago, to enforce a false narrative. You know, it's an extraordinary moment to have that strategy of narrative control fail as completely as it's failed. And it creates a space for us to really, you know, reckon with the reality. But we've known these things. You were reciting back, you know, through the decades, scandal after scandal. And in every instance, there's been this kind of effort to, as I said, circle the wagons and falsify the record. So, you know, this is an extraordinary opportunity, but we have to, you know, it's not simply a matter of video and social media. These are useful tools, but they're not sufficient in themselves. I mean, we as citizens, as journalists, have to really stay on this and give it sustained attention. If we do, it will save lives and it will make us all safer.
Jamie Kelvin, the executive director of the Invisible Institute. You've got a fascinating background that we want to delve into, after the break here. I mean, you worked at Stateway Gardens and you worked at the Henry Horner Homes, and that was two decades ago. So I kind of want, when we come back here, I want to get into why or how, at this point in time, when there is this much of a lens on everything that's going on, why will this be different? Because in a week, we know how we are. It'll all be yesterday's news, and that's just the reality. So yep. We'll talk about that coming back on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, we are talking to Jamie Kelvin, the executive director of the Invisible Institute. And this, Jamie, I wanted to just quickly, because we got about 5 minutes here, just, you know, you served as a consultant to the resident council of the Stateway Gardens Public Housing Development. All right, this is in the 90s. You were also involved as a consultant with the Henry Horner Homes. At Stateway, you created the Grassroots Public Works. So you have been working with ex-offenders, with gang members. You've seen how the police interact. So you're really involved in this. And with Laquan McDonald, you went out and you found that there was actually a video, and then you also were able to go out, and I guess, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you also pulled the autopsy report because you thought that something perhaps was suspicious. Is that accurate?
Right, and also found a civilian witness to the shooting. So, you know, I had gotten, a colleague and I, a civil rights lawyer who I do a lot of work with, we'd gotten a tip from somebody within the city, a whistleblower within the city, that the facts of the Laquan McDonald case were very different from what had been reported, that there was video, and that he was skeptical that it was going to be seriously investigated. And from all we've seen, I think his skepticism was warranted. And that, you know, that set me in motion as a journalist. But I wanted to come back to Stateway Gardens and that earlier work, because really that's where this police accountability, for me and my colleagues, where the police accountability effort began, because I would witness routinely, almost daily, various forms of police misconduct. And remember, you're talking about a desperately poor, embattled, abandoned community, high-rise public housing on South State Street.
I don't want to interrupt you, but what kind of stuff specifically?
So, you know, daily routine corruption, just taking drugs and money off young men in the drug trade without making arrests. Physical brutality, you know, people routinely beaten up, and just, you know, kind of vile racist behavior, utterances, racial slurs. And, you know, again, by no means every or most police officers operating in that setting, but there were some who just behaved that way every day. And so the question for me became, how can this be? And, you know, I'm a middle-class white guy from you know, elsewhere in the city. And to see these patterns and to see the sense of license and impunity with which those officers who were disposed to be abusive, you know, could behave in a setting like that, you know, raise the question of I know this is real because I'm observing it every day. What set of institutional arrangements would be required for this to exist in this form? And that's what really led to seeking documents about internal investigations and supervision and such.
Jamie Calvin joining us, I mean, just without getting into all of his credentials, veritable expert on a lot of things going on with the city and this investigation. When you were witnessing this misconduct, when you were working in that particular neighborhood, were you able to establish if it was in specific neighborhoods or was it more citywide?
Oh, you know, it's a very good question. So this is such a geographically specific phenomenon. It happens in some neighborhoods and not in others, to some people and not to others. And, you know, all of the data that we've been able to gather, and we have, you know, more than 56,000 individual complaints from citizens of police abuse. And there's a website, Citizens Police Data Project, where this is housed. When you go to that site, there's a map, there's a heat map of where the complaints come from in the city. And you won't be surprised that the most intense areas where the complaints come from are the south side and the west side of the city, you know, predominantly African-American areas of the city. So this is a, you know, this phenomena has a lot to do with race, with poverty, with conditions of abandonment. And as I said, it happens in certain places and not in others. You know, I should also emphasize that, and our statistics should demonstrate this, upwards of 80% of officers get 0 to 4 complaints in their entire careers. You know, 90% of officers roughly have less than 10 complaints in their entire careers. And then there's some officers and some groups of officers have an extraordinarily high number of complaints. And it's the failure of the city to look at those patterns. And they jump out at you, you know, but the way in which the internal investigations by IPRA and the Bureau of Internal Affairs have operated, it's almost as if it's designed not to connect the dots, you know, not to turn the data into meaningful knowledge. So it's, you know, the system is truly broken. And the encouraging news is that if we can fully acknowledge the realities, and then we can diagnose, you know, how to proceed, we can greatly improve accountability in Chicago. And that means preventing future Laquan McDonald's.
Jamie, can you stay with us after the top of the hour news?
Sure.
Okay, we'll put you on hold. We'll reconnect with you after the news. Jamie Calvin, the executive director and of the Invisible Institute, that really doesn't do it justice. I mean, this is a writer, a human rights activist. He's been all over the city, and the fact that
for decades,
and
working in this space.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating guy to have on the line. So we'll do that after news, and we'll have some music for you to lighten it up after that. And of course, if you want to join the conversation, feel free. 312-981-7200.
Yes.
Rob Martier's got the news coming up at midnight.
Yeah, we're going to get you right to that after this commercial break. Hannah Stanley and Mark Carmen filling in for Patty Vasquez on WGN. WGN, Hannah Stanley and Mark Carmen filling in for Patty Vasquez on the Pretty Late Show. We will be with you Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. On the line with us, we have Jamie Calvin. He is the executive director of the Invisibility Institute. I'm sorry, Invisible Institute? There it is.
They don't want to be Invisibility. Want to be in.
I went a little Harry Potter on you, and I apologize, Jamie. Here's the thing. What is going to be investigated right now, we believe, is this culture of cover up or something within the Chicago Police Department. But this has existed through multiple administrations. At what point does the mayor become responsible?
Yeah, that's certainly a question that's been much discussed. Mayor Emanuel has a lot to answer for in this, and he's acknowledged that with respect to the Laquan McDonald incident, and there's really been a dramatic shift in the way he has talked about these issues in the last week. He's now, as on your newscast, talking about longstanding systemic problems. This is a very new way of framing the issue on the mayor's part. I think it's important to recognize, though, that he inherited the sort of toxic culture of the police department, this dysfunctional culture. He's certainly open to sharp criticism for not doing more to address it. But I think it's fair to say that the political reality is that it would take, in the absence of a great crisis and upheaval like the one we're in the midst of right now, it would take extraordinary leadership to take on this kind of deeply entrenched culture. And I think, the drama about the mayor's situation is he certainly didn't provide that sort of leadership in the first four or however many years it's been of his administration. Now his political survival depends on doing so. I think we should take him at his word when he says he owns this problem and he's going to address it. He can't do it alone. I think it's necessary to have an aroused citizenry who stay alert to this issue, to have the press stay on it. And obviously it's a major development to have the Justice Department come into Chicago. So there are a lot of things happening at once. I think it's going to require, this is going to be a protracted process. It's going to take a long time. And it's going to require, as I say, sustained attention, but also a high level of statesmanship from everybody involved. This is an extraordinary, extraordinary moment and a potentially pivotal moment in the history of the city. I mean, those of us who have worked for decades on these issues are as amazed, I think, as anybody else in the city that the set of possibilities have opened up. And I think it really resembles, in some ways, the truth and reconciliation processes in some societies, South Africa after apartheid and Central Europe after totalitarianism, where whole societies go through processes of sort of reckoning with their histories and the past and the harms that have been inflicted in order to go forward, in order to develop into a different kind of society. And, fundamentally here, we are talking about a kind of apartheid. And then, when we're talking about the map of the city and where the abuse happens, and it's also where a great deal of violent crime happens, we're talking about a kind of apartheid justice system where the Constitution means different things in some neighborhoods than it means in other neighborhoods. So ultimately, we're not really only talking about reforming internal procedures of the police department. I think we're really talking now about, and I think this is the Black Lives Matter movement and this extended post-Ferguson moment we're in as a society. We're talking about what kind of society we are and whether we ultimately can provide and guarantee equal treatment under the law for all citizens. So, this is a much larger phenomenon now than the mayor and his administration. He has a role to play, and he's indicated that he has no higher priority than this right now. But I think it's going to take, you know, the whole society and all sorts of different groups and interest groups. It's not that everybody's pulling oars in the same direction, but I think there needs to be that level of engagement to be worthy of this historic moment.
I love what you're saying, Jamie, and it gives me hope that there is change. And listen, it's not just Chicago. I mean, Eric Garner, I Can't Breathe. I mean, everybody's, you know, any major metropolitan area basically has the same issues. Of course, we have to take care of our own situation first before looking at anyone else, and we have a lot to do here. But, like, I watched Chicagoland intently when it was on. And when you talk to people around that, they said that Rahm was great when the cameras were on, but when they weren't on him, you couldn't trust him at all. But you're talking right now like you actually have some hope in the mayor, and I'm wondering actually why.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, I don't know the mayor. I don't have any special knowledge about the mayor. I, like everybody else, you know, observe him as from the vantage point of a citizen. I think, you know, what I see has to do less with, you know, any kind of assessment of his character or his vision than with his circumstances. The circumstances he's in right now. The only way forward for the mayor to, this is the biggest crisis of his career. And it's not under control yet. It's, you know, every day it seems to more and more threaten his administration and his political viability, really, going forward. So, you know, he's obviously, as we all know, a very skilled political politician. And the only way forward for him, it seems to me, in this present context, is to address these issues and to address them effectively. He said that's what he's going to do, that those are just words. But I think his circumstances are such that he is, there are a lot of things pushing him in what could be a really constructive direction. Obviously, it's yet to be seen. And it's not, I mean, as I said, I think we all have roles to play in this. The press has been mostly asleep at the switch. I mean, there's this frenzy going on right now of media coverage. But, by and large in the city, the press has been satisfied to publish the police blotter, you know, when it comes to these shootings without really vigorously investigating. And I think all of us, as you were saying, this is not news. I mean, I'm in my late 60s. I've lived in Chicago all my life. I mean, my entire life, the theme of police brutality and corruption and impunity has been a motif through decades and decades. So this has all been in plain sight, you know, and I think...
And no one's cared, really.
Well, yeah, and we have, you know, I think this is really the fundamental issue about race in our society.
Yes.
Is our ability to know things and not know them at the same time. You know, for people who are completely, you know, morally awake and sensitive in their personal lives, to really tolerate intolerable conditions. And, you know, I think that's what we're grappling with as a society in these months since Ferguson and all the different instances. It's not as if there hasn't been a spike in police violence in the country. What we're seeing is the structural violence that's just built into American life. It's built into the society. And that's a very different thing from fixing, you know, for a crisis, if there were suddenly a malfunction of the police department or the different police departments across the country, that would be a different problem. What we're dealing with is this is the society we've created, and this violence is kind of built into the ongoingness of things. That's why I use the sort of South African truth and reconciliation image. We're really talking ultimately about becoming a different kind of society and making good on, our core principles of equal protection under the law. That's not the society we live in right now.
You mentioned that heat map where a lot of those complaints were coming from and where it was very localized with a lot of brutality and misconduct of the police department. You also mentioned a stat that the vast majority of our officers have very, very few complaints against them. So with the cleanup that we're hoping to see from this investigation, it really shouldn't affect a huge portion of the police department. Could this backfire on Rahm, where he could lose support of the police department, the CPD?
I think that's always a political. There are two ways in which the politicians traditionally have been really sort of inhibited from addressing these issues. One is, police are, especially in this city, a powerful voting bloc. Police officers and their families are traditionally a powerful bloc and the police union. But the other thing, and we've seen instances of this, as in New York, when Mayor de Blasio was seen as being critical of the police, the ability of the police to, there are different names for it, but sort of, blue flu, just sort of not show up or
turning their back on him when they were.
Yeah, they turn their back on him. But also if the police don't, I think the term is depolicing or something, when the police just kind of call it in, as an act of a kind of passive resistance to political leadership. So remember, before all of this exploded, by way of the Laquan McDonald case, the big issue in the city has been violent crime. And, and the mayor and the former superintendent, talked endlessly about guns and violent crime. I think, the other thing that I hope that the mayor and other political leaders are able to do is to begin to connect these two different conversations, these two different spheres of discourse. I think it's inevitably going to happen, and I think it'll be really healthy. We talk about gang violence, street violence, inner city violence, whatever terms, the sort of retaliatory violence, these patterns in certain neighborhoods, and we talk about police accountability as if these were separate subjects, as if they, and I think they're profoundly the same subject, and much of my work over the years has been in neighborhoods where people's experience of the police leaves them alienated from civil authority. And this is true of, this is true of young people. I spent a great deal of time talking to black teenagers on the South Side about their interactions with the police. And, smart, engaged kids who simply don't trust the police and don't cooperate with the police and are left with the puzzle of, how are you safe when you can't trust adult institutions and when you can't trust the institutions of the city? So a lot of the retaliation, we talk about the gang, no snitch, all of that. But, and I don't want to minimize phenomena like that. But I think a huge part of the lack of cooperation with the police in certain neighborhoods that, as you say, are, intense spots on those heat maps, a really significant factor is the lack of accountability. And, I've done a lot of sort of videotaped interviews with young people about the dealings with the police, and they consistently say two things, and this is, South Side neighborhoods, Englewood, Woodlawn, Grand Crossing. They say, when we have an encounter, I don't ask them about the worst thing that ever happened. I ask more about the daily routine, random stops, encounters with the police. They say the two things consistently, and they don't say it in the same words, but same thought. One is that when we have an encounter with the police, we know they have all the power. They have all the power. And the second thing is, if something happens, if something goes down, we won't be believed. And I think, on the basis of our statistics and, the lack of vigorous investigation of citizen complaints, particularly coming from certain neighborhoods, and the inability to to effectively curb abusive officers, the kids are right. They're empirically right. But it can lead them to make some very problematic decisions of their own about how to be safe. So it's bringing those conversations together, the violent crime and the sort of retaliatory cycles of violence and the alienation from the police in no small part because of the lack of accountability.
Jamie, phenomenal stuff. We really appreciate all the time that you gave us tonight, and really appreciate the work that you're doing when you're not with us on the radio, because that's probably the more important stuff. But really fascinating to listen to you tonight, and congratulations on everything you've done, and we look forward to talking to you again.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Well, that was great. Jamie Calvin, Executive Director of the Invisible Institute, and just long time entrenched behind the scenes of everything.
What a source.
What a source.
It's so much institutional memory of what has gone on in the city and in those neighborhoods.
Right. I mean, my biggest thing listening to the whole thing, do we care? Because most of us don't. I mean, that's just the reality. Or at least we haven't to this point. We say we do, but it's going to require, with your vote and however you're going to, maybe you get involved in some small way, to make the city better, and historically, we have not done that. We just haven't. That's the reality.
I don't know that a lot of people have known that they've needed to care.
Okay, that's possible. I mean, I'm not absolving myself. By the way, here,
no.
What have I done? Nothing.
It's incredibly challenging to question everything you see on TV and question the police, and it's hard.
Right.
It's hard.
Right. I just applaud him for. I mean, that's just awesome. He's been working. It's Stateway Gardens, at the Henry Horner Homes, and for this long, and then he's uncovering stuff on Laquan. I mean, really an amazing guy. All right, we got music coming up here, Hannah.
We do. After the 12:30 news, we have Forget Hannah.
That's outstanding.
You're Forget Mom.
They are looking really, really, really talented.
Ready.
There's a word. 720 WGN.